you know, life is just like, imagine there's a bunch of hills or mountains, right? And some of them are small, some of them are big, but you can't really connect the top of two mountains, right? But in order to get to the highest mountain, whatever the highest mountain means to you, you need to explore a bunch of different mountains. And what I find that a lot of people do is, again, they choose a mountain at first and they go up it, and then they just continue going up this mountain because there's like a sunk cost of going back down that mountain, right? They don't want to become a beginner again. They put all this effort into exploring one thing. But again, remember, you chose to go up that mountain based on the information that your brain, your AI had at that time.
Hello everyone, I am Reza and you're listening to Out of Curiosity, a podcast where I pick the brain of entrepreneurs and creators to learn about their mindsets, habits, and life philosophies. On the show with me today is Steph Smith. Steph leads a content team over at Trends, one of the most popular business newsletters out there, and she also writes on her own personal blog on topics like remote work, productivity, writing, and learning. On top of all that, she also has a few side projects on the go, including a book that she self-published late last year in 2020 on how to go about creating and distributing content online, which I highly recommend checking out. We're going to link out to it in the show notes so you can grab it from there. I've been following Steph's work for quite some time, and I really appreciate how intentional Steph's been about her life and career choices and the projects that she's chosen to work on. And this intentionality is one of the topics that we're going to cover on our conversation today. We'll also talk about learning and how she taught herself how to code in less than 12 months. And finally, we'll cover her writing and creative process. This was a super fun and insightful conversation, and I'm really excited to be sharing it with you all. So without further ado, enjoy, take notes, but more importantly, take action. Steph, really appreciate you taking the time to be here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Back in 2016, you said no to a stable corporate job and chose a nomadic life. I'm curious, what was the underlying reason to take that leap?
Yeah, so I was working in business consulting, just this boutique firm in Toronto, and it was just like the culmination of many things that pushed me in that direction. So it's a pretty classic story. Like, I was commuting 2 hours a day. I was working in like a very classic office, working, since it was in consulting, working with very corporate clients. And I was literally working my life away. It wasn't as bad as something like banking, but it was to the point where I would wake up at, let's say, 7:30, leave the house by 8, get to work by 9, spend 9 till, like, I think on average it was around 7, you know, is when I would leave. Would never leave before 6. And so then I would get home at 8, and then, you know, the cycle repeated. And so I just remember being like, really, is this it? And the summer before spending that year in consulting, so that was the first year out of college that I was working, I had done this big trip around the world to like Asia, Europe, just a ton of places, Australia. And I had traveled before that, but I remember specifically on that, you know, it was like a 4-month trip, because I really felt like, this is it. I remember that feeling of like, I remember it near the end, I was in a hostel in Thailand with the girl I was traveling with. And we were just kind of like, wow, when are we ever going to be able to do this again? And the answer was like, oh, maybe on these like 2-week stints sometime in the future. And I just remember that really stuck with me throughout that year when I was like living in that cycle, being like, really? Like, this is it? Like, this is actually my future. And then with that kind of seed of doubt, I guess, of like, do I really want to be doing this? I started being introduced to different things, like people working remotely and still advancing their careers or still like having great jobs and following their passions and stuff like that. And then just throughout that year, I started exploring that more. And then eventually I found that I could do that. And I ended up finding a job that was more in tech, and it was like a growth marketing role, and I was still advancing my career. And alongside that, I could, you know, go travel the world. And to me, that was just a no-brainer, where I could just go and design my life the way I wanted to, and with the freedom to determine what I wanted to spend my time doing. And that's what I did. And that's why I only spent a year in the corporate world. It was kind of a very sudden reaction to, wow, is this really it?
How much of that was a quest for something more meaningful versus doing something that's more exciting?
It was more so that I just knew that whether it came from a sense of meaning or adventure, that there was more out there, right? And that would be left for me to define or find, right? Like what I was really searching for. But the idea was that surely this can't be it. Surely, like, I can't, and alongside that, not just this can't be it, but am I really choosing my path based on what everyone else has defined before me, right? Like, this is the journey that everyone takes, right? They go and they get a job, and then they work their way up that job, and then they get paid more, and then they start a family, and then, it's a very clear path, and a surprising number of people follow that path. And it was more so, really, am I not going to define this for myself? And it wasn't so much a sense of like, oh, there must be more meaning out there, or I need to hit the road and you know, live a life of adventure, because that really wasn't what was feeling me. It was more so, like, what do I actually want? I'm not sure, because I'm like a 21, 22 year old. But what I do know is that I should be able to make this decision, and I should go explore. You know, there's this concept in computer science, which is like explore and exploit. And it's this idea that, like, why am I skipping this explore phase when they're before actually getting to the exploit phase? It's like, I've just like skipped this. I didn't find out what I would actually like, or what would make me happy, or what would make me even most successful. I haven't gone through that phase. Why am I just falling into this exploit phase, if that makes sense?
You are 100% certain what you don't want to do, but you didn't know what you're eventually going to do.
Exactly. And that's been a kind of theme that I've discovered consistently since then, is that I was asked this the other day on a session I was doing, where someone was like, what advice would you give to yourself 5 years ago, just graduating college? And it was honestly that you need to embrace uncertainty. You need to embrace that, like, you don't know where you're going to be in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, or even 3 years. I kind of live by this principle these days of, you know, you can have long-term goals that are kind of lofty, of like, I want to be successful, or whatever that means to you, but you have no idea how you're going to get there. In terms of like tangible planning, I don't really plan out much further than 6 months or so ahead, because you just, the way I like to view it is, your brain is an AI, right? And it functions off of information that it gets consistently, right? It's a very advanced AI, but it functions off of information and it grows, right? And so why would you make decisions about something so far into the future, knowing that your brain, this AI, will encounter information that'll help you make decisions in the future more effectively? So why would you kind of adhere to saying, I need to make decisions about the future now, when you have this opportunity to integrate better information in the interim? So that's why I think in general, this principle of like, I know what I certainly don't want. So the AI already knows stuff that it doesn't want to engage with, that probably won't change. But what you do want, that will change over time. It is the sense of like, just, you don't know where you're going to get. And there are so many paths in life, and there's not one right or wrong, but you should explore enough so that you can find ones that are better for you, right? Explore a bunch of things and then find one that's pretty good, not perfect, but pretty good for you.
So not limiting your curiosity and being aware of all the options. And then through that, kind of know yourself as well. What is it that you actually like?
Yeah, I'd like to view, I didn't make this up. I've heard many people talk about life in this perspective, but you know, life is just like, imagine there's a bunch of hills or mountains, right? And some of them are small, some of them are big, but you can't really connect the top of two mountains, right? But in order to get to the highest mountain, whatever the highest mountain means to you, you need to explore a bunch of different mountains. And what I find that a lot of people do is, again, they choose a mountain at first and they go up it, and then they just continue going up this mountain because there's like a sunk cost of going back down that mountain, right? They don't want to become a beginner again. They put all this effort into exploring one thing. But again, remember, you chose to go up that mountain based on the information that your brain, your AI had at that time, right? So it's this sense of like, as you go up the mountain, you learn things, you see other mountains, like the view becomes clearer, you see other opportunities. But what a lot of people do is they say, oh, well, I'm already, you know, halfway up this mountain, let me just continue, instead of accepting that maybe you didn't have all the answers, you didn't have enough of this explore phase to actually just like make the conscious choice to go right back down that mountain, go up another mountain, explore, come right back down, until you find a mountain that, where you're like, you know what, this is, I'm very happy with this. And, you know, based on all the mountains that I've explored, this feels right. This feels pretty good. And I'm making this decision, and it's not based on a sunk cost. It's just that I really am enjoying this path today.
On that note, what's your take on specializing in your career versus being a polymath?
That's an interesting question. I think in general, there is not necessarily a right answer there, in the sense that, like, if you want to, you know, the world needs both, basically, is the idea, in the sense that we do need people who are highly specialized. That actually helps us progress, right? But you also benefit from being a polymath in that it helps uncover layers that I think sometimes people who are specialized are unable to, because they don't have the perspective or the context of these other fields. And I think in general, specialization will more quickly be overtaken by automation, in the sense, because anything that is specialized tends to be more easily replicable or easy to identify, like, oh, this is what we, you know, this is what we do in this field and this is how it works. And you obviously need experts spearheading the curb of that field. But at the same time, I think where we find kind of like interesting new things is through the intersection of what already exists. Like most things out there are the intersection of things that already exist. And for that reason, I, for example, have, I would say, if you were to say, Steph, are you specialized or are you polymath? I'd say I'm more of a polymath than someone that's specialized. And then on top of that, I think it really just functions on what you want to do, right? To become really specialized in something, again, the world needs it, but it's less interesting for the person in most situations. Like I used to work in academic research for several summers during my degree in university. And I worked with these professors, and that is exactly what they're doing. They're specialized. When you work in any sort of academic research, for example, one of the summers I worked on just a very specific type of asphalt processing so that roads would crack less. Very, very specific type as well. And so for that person, this man, he loved it. And he, at least, or so he said, at least, right? But he was spending the rest of his life in this very, very specialized niche. And that's great. And that helps us advance, right? That's, you know, that's how science advances. But what I'm getting at is that for each individual person, like, some people really struggle to find that one thing that they're going to want to specialize for the rest of their life. And so again, to kind of sum up what my perspective here is, that A, neither of them is right or wrong. We need both in the world. And B, I think that we're going to see a lot more polymaths because certain parts of specialization will get automated. And then C, if you are going to specialize, just keep in mind that I think is harder to, it's really hard to find an area of specialization where you're willing to basically dedicate your life to that thing. And so if you can find that, wonderful, the world can benefit from it. But I think a lot of people struggle to find that one thing.
Speaking of goals, you tend to share your goals for the year publicly on your website. What's the correlation between that and your motivation to accomplish those goals?
Yeah, so it's funny because I share a lot of those goals now, and it's been a mix of me wanting to do that for accountability purposes, but also, of course, that this concept of building in the open is something that I believe helps basically you form connections with people when, the way I like to put it, is when you're not winning. And what I mean by that is when you're building in the closed, which is what most people do, the only way to bring people into your story or your projects or whatever you're trying to achieve is through launches, or when you've like, hey, like I've been working on this project for 6 months and now it's here. Here you go, everyone, check out my project. And that's cool, but that's more so like, hey, go buy my stuff or check out my awesome project. It's when you're winning, right? Hey, everyone, here's a launch. But I think there is this amazing opportunity to, when you build in the open through sharing your goals, or a lot of people think building in the open is just sharing revenue and stuff. It can be anything from like opening your roadmap to like actually sharing exactly how you achieve something or bringing people in and asking for help. Things like that are all building in the open. You have this opportunity to bring people in when you're not winning, right? So when you're just building. So there's two analogies that I like to give for building in the open. The first one is you're working in your garage anyway. Let's say you're working on a project. You just open your garage door. That's what you're doing. You're allowing people to see the whole process and be a part of it. And then the second is this idea of people are more likely to, if your car breaks down, help you push your car if you're already pushing it. And so no one can help you push your car if it never breaks down. So the sentiment of like, if you're building anyway, people are more likely to come help you if you're sharing what you're doing, but also if you're just sharing not always the wins, if you're just sharing everything, the wins, the highs, lows, things like that. And I've seen that personally, where the whole reason I started building the open in the first place was because my very first project that I launched on Product Hunt was this thing called Nomad Hub. And I launched it and it really wasn't that great of a project. I think it came like eighth or something. I don't even remember now. But I tweeted about it and it got a bunch of attention because Product Hunt retweeted it. And none of the comments I noticed were about Nomad Hub. None of them. All of them were like, because the text of the tweet was like, just spent the last 6 months learning to code and launched this project. All of them were about that. People were like, oh, I want to learn to code, or like, how did you do this? Or can you help me learn to code as well? What courses did you take? They were all interested in the journey to launching this product, not necessarily the product itself. And so ever since then, I've just really recognized and benefited from this realization that if you share in the open, people are more likely to want to be part of that story because they can be part of it before it's over, right? Before the launch. And I've really benefited from it over the last couple of years. And so I've just continued to do it. And I think the final thing I'd say about building in the open is a lot of people are afraid to build in the open for two reasons. One is because they think that no one's going to pay attention. And I think that's fine. Sometimes they don't pay attention, but it's this, again, this garage idea where the way you can go wrong with building open is, imagine the same garage analogy, but then you go and you take your table where you're building and you put it outside and you get like a big pink sign and like balloons and stuff. That's not what I'm talking about. You're not trying to say, hey, everyone, look at what I'm building. Like, please pay attention. You're just opening the door. So that's, as long as you're not doing that, I think you're okay. So the second reason that people sometimes go wrong with building the open is that they think that by sharing things, especially if you're sharing your journey, that people may steal your ideas, or there will be copycats, or you're basically hindering your chance of success. And I think that that certainly has some merit, but I think you can get past that mentality by just recognizing that the world can be a positive sum game, and that, you know, if you've ever heard of Derek Sivers' ideas versus execution framework, if you truly believe in that, where ideas are worth almost nothing and execution is worth everything or almost everything, then sharing your stuff in the open doesn't matter. You're not hindering your chances of success because you're kind of betting on your ability to execute whatever you're sharing out there. Now, if you can't back up your, you know, ideas with your execution, then that's another problem. It doesn't matter if you share in the open or not, you're not going to be successful. So those are two ways that I sometimes hear people push back in terms of building in the open. But I think if you, A, don't make building the open so flashy, you're just opening your garage door, and B, you believe in your own ability to execute, then I think you're fine.
From learning to code in less than a year to self-publishing a book on your own and making close to $40,000 from it in a few weeks, how do you typically approach learning and doing things for the first time?
That's a really good question. I think, at least for me, in the last couple of years, I've been really lucky, but it's been an intentional way to set up my life in that I have been working a full-time job alongside this, which is a lot more work from sheer, you know, I have to work full-time in addition to whatever I do on the side. But I've written about this concept where, because of that, I have this like lack of mental instability where, for example, I know I'm going to get a paycheck at the end of the week. I know I'm going to get a paycheck at the end of the month. I know that no matter how my side projects do, whether I'm learning to code, whether I'm writing a book, like, I'm good. And for that reason, I am able to make decisions based on this concept of like following your curiosity, right? Where if I wake up one day, I'm not like, God, I really need to learn to code because I don't have a job and I need to get one. It's like, oh, I really want to be able to like build this random site of untranslatable words. Like, how do I get there? Oh, I guess I need to learn to code. And like, how am I going to learn to code? Well, I can choose any which way. If it takes me like 3 weeks or 3 years, that's okay, because I'm in a rush because I'm ambitious, but I'm not in a rush because I'm like held against the wall and I need to make money tomorrow. And I think your brain just naturally operates in different ways when you aren't held up against the wall, and when you can follow your curiosity. So for me, to get back to your question, like, what do I do when I'm first trying to learn something? It's A, starting with something that I'm actually interested in, because I think what a lot of people do is they, for example, they're like, I need to learn to code because everyone says that it's important. Well, you need to, at least if you're going to kind of start there, figure out why you want to do it. And it can be anything from like, oh, I really want to build this app, to like, I want to be able to, you know, I'm like a designer, I want to be able to work with like the dev team more effectively, where it actually makes sense to you. And there's a motivation there for you to want to actually engage in that practice. And then from there, it's finding ways that, again, you're kind of like, working with your psychology, not against it, finding ways that you would actually enjoy engaging in that thing, right? So for example, there are many different ways of learning to code. You could take a Udemy course. There are things that are more like article-based. There's ways that like Peter Levels have talked about, for example, where he literally is just like, I just want to go create an app. So I'm just going to start from like an empty console and like just code it, right? Like I'm just, and just Google everything along the way. So figuring out like how you learn best, I think is really, really important. But I think at the core of the reason that I've been able to create so many projects over the last couple of years is just because a lot of them are just fueled by my own curiosity and my own motivations, not fueled by this like, oh shit, like I need to wake up tomorrow and build a product that's going to make me a couple thousand this month. So I think that's been really helpful. And I would encourage other people to do the same where I think a misconception is a lot of people think that your job has to be your passion. You always have to marry the two, and it can be, and it's a beautiful thing if it is, but I think it's perfectly fine. If like, I really like my job at Trends, it's not necessarily the thing that I like would build if I was building a company from scratch on my own, but I love it. It motivates me. I'm very happy there and it pays my bills. And then on the side, I'm free to do whatever I want. And I can have so much fun doing that. And for that reason, because I'm enjoying it, I continue to show up every day.
Growing up, you played competitive chess. What did that experience teach you that you apply to other areas of your life?
Yeah, so it's so funny because chess, there's now that Netflix series that everyone is watching. And so chess is getting a lot of attention. It's becoming cooler now, but I played chess as a kid, and it's funny looking back because chess has become more interesting for people recently. This question has come up a lot, and it is a little bit of kind of like piecing things together backwards where I think I learned these things, but who knows if I actually did at the time. Mm-hmm. But I think there's two key things that stand out to me. One of them is this concept of basically chess, there is no luck in chess. Like, there are other games like poker, even like physical sports, there is some degree of luck. Even with the soccer game, did it rain that day? I used to play soccer competitively as well. Like, did someone on your team get injured? Like, did you just not, you know, feel like physically well that day? There's lots of ways that you can make excuses in other games, but with chess, there is no luck, really. Like, the best player wins, at least the best player on that day, for that game, they win based on the moves that they've played. And so the amazing thing about chess is that you not only are judged by purely your game, but you can very, very easily see the investment that you put in and how that relates to your game. So a lot of people don't realize, unless they've played competitive chess, you study, you have a coach, you read books about chess, you, after a game, you study your games with your coach after, you play tons of games throughout many years, like hundreds, thousands of games, that slowly you can see your effort and investment resulting in something that is tangible, because not just your wins and losses are what you track. In chess, you have a rating. You can see your rating go up and down with every game that you play. And so it's this very, very closed loop, which is great, where you can see
gradual progression.
The work that you put in over a long period of time, and that how that results in your betterment or your success in the game. And again, there's no excuses, right? So if you lose, you lose because you lost or you played the worst moves. And so I remember specifically when I was really young, for example, you know, even though I played chess competitively, I didn't always love it, where I remember times where like I'd be like lying on the couch and I'd be like, Mom, like, I don't want to read my chess book, or like, I don't want to show up to my lesson or whatever. And she would just say, she'd be like, fine, but if you want to improve, if you want to beat, you know, whatever this person, you better go to your lesson, or you better read your books, or you better play these games, because it's the only way you get better in chess. And so I think that was a huge lesson, is just that it, from the beginning, it taught me that no matter where you start, if you invest a lot of time, a lot of effort into mastering something, you can do that. And I really think that mentality has carried through, where, for example, with coding, it was something that a lot of people maybe would shy away from or say, I'm not technical. But as soon as I decided I was going to learn to code, I just did it. I was like, I know I can do this if I just put enough time and effort into that. So I think that's something that stuck around with me. And then also this sense of, in chess, or at least the board itself, there is no bias. In the sense that, again, the best person wins regardless if they're a woman, if they're a man, if they're 50, if they're 7. When I first started playing chess, similar to the show on Netflix, I literally started playing when I was like 4 or something. I don't remember when I started learning to play chess. And so then by the time I was like 8 or 9 or 10, I was playing against like literally face to face with 50-year-old men in tournaments, and sometimes winning, sometimes losing, of course, but that really instilled in me this sense of confidence where it doesn't matter who you are or what your background is. Kind of tied to the first point, if you do the work, you can become the best at anything, no matter what your background is or how people view you. So I think that has instilled a certain confidence in me where even now I work in male-dominated fields or things like that, where I just know that if you show up, if you do the work, if you are the best that you possibly can be, then that's what matters. So I think chess was really interesting, where at the time, again, it was just this game that I played that I didn't really think about in terms of these structures or these takeaways. But now looking back, I feel like they did definitely have an impact on those.
Did you ever ask your parents why they encouraged you to play chess?
I mean, it was definitely my dad that did. Both me and my sister were chess players from a very young age, and I think he just loved the game. By the time we were 10, I think we were better than him. So he wasn't amazing at chess, but he was good and he found it interesting. And I think he wanted us to be successful in some way. So he actually put us in a ton of different things, not just chess. Like I said, I played soccer, I played baseball, I played all different types of sports and activities, dance, pottery classes. I think my parents just always wanted us to find something that we would kind of adhere to and love and pursue. They kind of gave us the freedom to figure out what that was. But I think at an early age, we both really were, you know, I don't think there's people who are necessarily naturals at chess, but I think we like grew into the game pretty quickly. And then from there, I think it just gave us an avenue to spend our time. I also remember at a very young age, my mom would, like, my sister did this less, but I would consistently be like, "Mom, I'm bored." And she's like, "Well, like, you need to learn to not be bored. Like, there are so many opportunities and things that you can learn and love and experience. This is the one thing that you cannot do. You cannot be bored." And so that was something that I very clearly remember from a young age. So I don't know if they chose chess for us as much as, like, me and my sister ended up loving the game at that time. But they did very clearly want us to go and explore things and, you know, find things that we would pursue.
Who's your favorite soccer team?
Man, I don't play. Well, so I'm from Canada. We don't really have soccer teams that we follow as much as, you know, in Europe. So I don't have a favorite soccer team, unfortunately. And I haven't played competitively in many, many years. But I quit chess when I was, I think, around like 12 or something. It was pretty early on because it was also like a really grueling sport. And then that's when I started going into soccer. And then I played soccer for, I don't know, from then until like I went to university, but it's been a while since then.
Got it. There's a quote by Steve Jobs. I'm going to read it out for anyone listening. "Life can be so much broader once you discover one simple fact, and that is that everything around you that you call life was made up by people who were no smarter than you. You can change it. You can influence it. You can build your own things that other people can use. Once you learn that, you'll never be the same person again." When did you first hear that? And what was your initial reaction to it? How much of it was an aha moment for you?
You know, even if we relate this to the things that I was just saying about chess, where if you, from an early age, if you play against people who are much older than you, or if you're a woman and you're playing against men, it's this eye-opening moment when you sit down at a chessboard and you play a 50-year-old and you're 7 and you beat them, where you're like, wow, like all of these like constructs that exist in the world don't necessarily actually exist. Like, we've formed them. And so same thing with the Steve Jobs quote, where if you just recognize that everything in this world is built by people just like you, who started as babies, who knew nothing, and then grew to build whatever they have ended up building, that just means that you can too. And I've had many instances like this in my life where I've gone into something and felt really worried or scared or incompetent. And then, for example, even in my single year of consulting, I'd work with execs from the Fortune 500, and we'd create these like models and we'd show them in these decks. And very early on, it wasn't so much that I was smarter than them, but I was just as capable as them, or I could be, right? So maybe in that moment I wasn't, but I just saw that they were still figuring things out. They still were learning. They still felt incompetent at times. And then, so that, similar to the chess instance, was just another data point where it's like, wow, like literally everyone I encounter who at the beginning I think is like super impressive or so much better than me or whatever is really just another human figuring things out. And then just certain humans have spent more time in certain places or who have been exposed to certain things that others haven't. And so in the last couple of years, I really do have felt more and more and more, the more I experience that everyone is figuring things out. No one is truly, you know, miles ahead of anyone else. And that's really empowering, right? It's not meant to be like, oh, like everyone's dumb and no one knows what they're doing. It's actually this sense of, wow, look at all of the incredible things that exist in this world. And like, I can go create some of these things or completely new things. And that's what I think a lot of people really respect in Elon Musk. I know he's a personality as well, but I think a lot of people really respect the sense that he woke up one day and decided, I'm going to go and improve X, Y, and Z in the world. I'm just going to go do it. And I think that's really commendable to just have that mentality of, I can change anything. And I think more people, or I think the world would benefit if more people had that mentality.
When it comes to getting things done, you seem to have a system for front loading your week and get as much as done as possible early in the week. Talk more about that. How is that helping you to de-stress and be more productive?
Yeah, so I think in general, something to keep in mind is that the week, similar to what we were just saying about how there's like social constructs, like the concept of a week is a social construct, right? Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday,
Sunday. Why 7 days?
Yeah, why 7 days? Why structured where it's 24 hours a day? Why, of course, this relates to science and when the sun comes up, when the sun comes down. But the idea here is that all of this is a social construct in terms of how we operate, how we work. And I think what's really important is that once you realize that, then especially now that everyone's working remotely, you can design your week however you are most productive. And for me, something that weighs me down, and I think it weighs a lot of people down, we were actually just talking about this before the podcast, this sense of like things to be done, things that are pending, and it's just this mental load. And so for me, something that I love is getting ahead of that. I remember in junior high-ish or so, I was totally a procrastinator. I'd be that person who gets the assignment in, you know, or does the assignment the day before it's due. And then one day I just started doing things earlier. And it wasn't because I was organized. I'm actually, from a classical standpoint, really disorganized. But I realized, like, whoa, I feel so much better when this is just, it's just done. It's just done before it needs to. And I don't have to spend these whole weeks kind of like in the back of my mind worrying about these things. So that's what I do with my work as well, where, I mean, of course, with a job, there's kind of like endless things to do. But if you clearly map out what would make me feel like this week was successful, and then you go and you do like 2/3 of that in like one day or 2 days, you're like, oh my gosh, I feel so much better. And then you're more likely to enjoy the tasks that are to come as well. Just, there's just a mental barrier. It's like, imagine you had to carry a bunch of bricks, you know, throughout your day or throughout your week, and you have to walk X distance. Let's say you have to walk 5 miles, no matter what. Well, wouldn't you be happier if you could drop off half of those bricks in the first mile, right? Because there is really this mental load when you just know things are coming, right? They need to be done. And so that's how I structure my week. I, ever since I started working remotely, have used that as this opportunity to schedule my week how I want, how I'm most effective. And that has evolved over time, over a lot of, you know, iteration and figuring out what's best for me, in Mondays being really heavy, Tuesdays being pretty heavy. And then by the end of the week on Friday, like, I'm recording this podcast with you, right? Like, that's not my core work because I've accomplished so much already in the beginning of the week.
I love that brick analogy. And as someone who is quite a last minute person, I love that last minute pressure to get things done, which is not a positive thing. I'm not proud of it, but I completely relate to that brick analogy and how it weighs me down throughout the week. And it's so much better to just like get some of it done. It doesn't have to be all done, but at least you're progressively getting closer to the end.
Yeah. I saw this tweet a while ago that was like, it was like, good news, I just finished a task that's been on my to-do list for 8 months in 7 minutes. And it was way less stressful than I thought. It's like, imagine the stress of, you know, that accumulated over those 8 months. And really, it was just like a 7 minute task. And so I'm totally with you. Sometimes I leave stuff to the last minute. And there's definitely cognitive load that even right now we were talking about, I have this like list of articles to read. But the more that you can get rid of that, more often than not, the like cognitive load is worse than the task itself. So you just have to push yourself to do the task and get it over with. And you'll most of the time realize, oh, that actually wasn't so bad.
When it comes to writing, how do you choose what to write about?
Yeah. So for me, again, this is different than perhaps someone who is writing for work, let's say, like writing for their full-time job and how they make their income. But because I don't have to do that. I just write about what makes me curious. And so anything from like, I see a tweet that I, you know, like sparks some insight for me where I'm like, oh, like people seem to misunderstand this thing, or this is a really interesting concept that I think people can learn from. But I would say overall, what I try to edge towards with my writing and when I choose topics is this concept, which I didn't make up, but this concept of a personal monopoly. Like, what do I know, or what can I comment on, or what can I write about that I, in such a way that I actually come from a place of expertise, or I know about this thing in a way that I can actually drive value, and not just, you know, vaguely topics that I see on the internet that I'm like, oh, that sounds interesting, but like, I know nothing about. Because I think in layering on that like layer of experience or expertise, you're just able to communicate things more effectively. You're able to add more nuance as well. You're able to use things like humor in ways that you can't if you don't understand a topic. So for example, one of the first articles that I wrote was this guide to remote work. There's a lot of guides to remote work. Well, my guide, which ended up getting a lot of attention, especially considering I had no audience at the time, what the title was, the guide to remote work that's not trying to sell you anything. And I could only write that title based on having worked remotely for a long time and understanding like how people were curating the content for remote workers, the nuances there, how those nuances were being judged, and therefore I could write that title, right? So I think in general, I do scope out ideas everywhere, but in terms of the ideas that I actually, you know, put pen to paper with are ideas that I do think at least I have some sort of expertise that allows me to be more creative in that process.
Some of the posts you've published, you've spent as long as 6 months on them. What happens over that period? Do you intentionally wait that long? What's that creative process like?
Yeah, so again, this is stemming from this idea that I don't have a calendar, right? I don't have deadlines, at least with my creative work. And I think that's, for me, a good thing because, yeah, some articles I literally have written in a day, but that's rare. And some articles, they span many, many months for the reason that they all start with some sort of seed of like, you know, this is something that I think is interesting or I can write about. And then from there, I start to just think about things more deeply, right? But I think about them in a passive way, because I think when they're forced, if you sit down, and you're like, I need to get out all my thoughts about this thing. It's really, really hard to do. So for example, I always like to give the analogy that like when you're young and someone's like, oh, like you always do this. And then you're like, what, give me proof. And they're like, oh damn, like I know I have proof, but like, I can't think of anything. I think our brains just work in a way where, you know, certain things get buried in the like mesh that is our AI. And unfortunately, when, if you're just forced to go and service everything at once, it's really hard, right? And so I try to give myself this passive time to have things resurface both within my brain, but then also externally. So the second part of that is, as I've kind of sometimes gotten an idea of what I want to write about, sometimes I have an idea, but it's not fully fleshed out, in which case I can benefit from both the passive thinking on my end, but also, you know, I stumble across a tweet or listen to a podcast or I watch a webinar or I experience all these things and things start to basically feed into that original seed, right? It starts to grow. It starts to get branches and it basically becomes the article over time through me thinking about it and experiencing other things. And then also sometimes there's like an additional kind of like intentional research stage where I'm like, okay, I think I have most of what I want to try to say, but I need to research this angle or I need to understand this a little more deeply. But that is the reason it takes months sometimes, because I want to give it the space to become the best article that it can be. And I don't think that I can do that in most cases, not all cases, but most cases, by forcing it down a certain timeline. So again, this is what I mean when I said earlier that I benefit from this idea that I'm not pushed against the wall to create things. I let them take their time. I let them become the creations that I want them to be without these artificial deadlines in most cases. And that's, I think, the most true with these articles.
After traveling and living in close to over 50 countries, what are some things that we all have in common, regardless of where we are from?
Yeah, so I think, so first of all, what you said is completely spot on, that we're a lot more alike than we are different, regardless of its country or sexual orientation or even political party. Obviously, politics are crazy right now, but we're a lot more alike than we think. And I think as humans, we, for whatever reason, I don't know, you know, the psychology of this, we tend to imagine that we're, you know, apart instead of actually addressing our similarities. One thing that's true across, you know, people I've encountered, I've been nomadic for many years and encountered other nomads, is that another thing we do, which is funny, is that we tend to think we want certain things. And in reality, there are very simple things that every human wants. So for example, when you start nomading, that you want a life of adventure and that you want to like go see everything that there is in the world and constantly meet new people. But I think as humans, there are certain things that really drive us and make us happy, and their community, right? A consistent community, things like routine. And when I say routine, it's not necessarily like a strict routine where you're like, I do this at 9 a.m., but things that are familiar, right? We actually all like things that are familiar to us. And actually, now that I'm speaking about this on this podcast, that may be something that actually drives us apart, because depending on where you grow up, certain things are familiar to you and you think those are correct, or you think that those are, you know, how everyone else should live. But what's important here is not what is familiar to you, but just that humans like familiarity. And so I've experienced this throughout years of nomading, where I've met so many nomads, and everyone, especially, this really was the reason I wrote that guide to remote work. A lot of people think that when you first start nomading, you're going to be so happy. And most of the time it's the opposite. You go and you travel and you see all these things, but you have no one to share it with, or you are really struggling to like establish anything familiar, whether it's your routine, whether it's where you work out, where you, you know, work from, the hobbies that you have, all those things disappear. And you actually realize that those are the things that make us happy as humans. And I see that with everyone, no matter where you're from. And that is why most of the people, or a lot of the people that work remotely, they go and they do this, you know, kind of crazy period where they go and travel and see a bunch of stuff. And then almost everyone I know that started that way ends up becoming what we call a slow mad, which is someone who either fully settles down, or at least slows down in such a way that you are really just going back to the same places. And every time you go, you spend several months, if not years, in those places. So I think that is something that unites everyone. This is like yearning for community and familiarity, whatever that is to each individual person.
What about a place would make you want to stay there for longer than other places?
Yeah, so I think at least where people first start to go as nomads, they tend to go just because they're working, they tend to go for places that have, you know, fast internet, good weather, relatively cheap. But that's kind of at a macro level, right? So that's why certain places like Medellin, Chiang Mai, Chengdu have all become nomad hotspots. But again, that's at a macro level. Where did people tend to go first? And then now, in terms of the reason that those places are thriving, are at a micro level of each individual person asking that question of like, what would make me want to stay here? And yeah, sometimes it's that they don't have that much money and they're going for cheap places, but more so, where's the community? And because most nomads ended up kind of coordinating in these places, there's more of a community there. And that's why, like Chengdu, for example, there are many reasons to love Chengdu, but if you were to ask, you know, 90%+ of the people why they stay in Chengdu, it's because their friends are there now, right? It's a sense of community that you cannot get if you're just, you know, going to some random town where there's not good co-working spaces or good kind of like central grounds for people to connect. So I think in general, there are reasons why people, you know, choose certain places based on cost of living or weather or things like that. But I think more so, especially now that most of the world is remote, or at least currently remote, you're going to see a lot more people going to certain places based on their like cultural values, what they prioritize, and how those communities form. So that's what I would say in terms of how people end up really, really settling down in specific places.
You touched on this earlier. You made a directory of words that don't translate. I first came across this whole concept when I went to Brazil and I was introduced to saudade, which is the feeling of longing for someone. Was this directory a byproduct of your travels and kind of hearing these words when you travel to these different places?
So it wasn't actually a result of hearing the words, but it was very early on when I was traveling more as a backpacker. You would see all these people on Instagram, for example. They would, you know, there's all these words associated with travel, like wanderlust. And those are, at least some of them, are untranslatable words. Also, early on when I was exploring remote work, I came across Remote Ear, which most people know now. But as it was first growing, they would call all of their remote year groups these words as well. So things like Kaizen, which is a Japanese word, for example. And so I started to be exposed to those kind of through that angle, through just like seeing them within the travel community. And then I just started to explore them more. And I just, in general, went down a rabbit hole one day and was like, wow, if there's all these words within travel, like surely there's other words outside of just, you know, the sense of travel. And of course there was. And then it really got cemented when I went to Japan, because I didn't hear the words there. But if you've ever been to Japan, it is so interesting. The culture there is so different than anywhere I've ever been. And you can just get a sense of the Japanese culture through actually exploring some of their untranslatable words. So to give you a sad example is there's a word called karoshi, which just means like suicide death, which basically means that a bunch of people are literally dying at their desks because they're working too hard. So that's one example of where something happens in this society enough that it is, you know, beneficial for them to actually create a word to articulate this thing that's happening and to capture the nuance of that experience. And that is a sad example, but there's many, you know, happier or more fun examples within Japanese culture. But when I went to Japan, it all kind of made sense that you just like experience that culture and you're like, okay, like these words really do in some way, shape or form capture some segment of the experience of being in Japan or being able to experience the Japanese culture. So that really, I think, got me down even further in the rabbit hole. And then eventually I was like, you know what? I just want to know what all of these words are. And so creating that site was a way for me to basically crowdsource a bunch of them.
Yeah, there's definitely something about languages. Even when I know a couple of words about a language and I talk to people from that country, there seems to be an instant connection. You don't need to say anything else. You know, you're speaking my language. I've definitely noticed that. The book, Man's Search for Meaning, how did that shape the person you are today?
Yeah, it's an amazing book. I think still to this day, it's my favorite book. It's funny, funnily enough, I did not read very much in, you know, high school, even university, at least for leisure, of course. And that was the first book that got me back into reading because it captured. So the way that I like to look at books now is like, you can go throughout your life and just like learn from your experiences or the people that you're around, but books basically have taken the best stuff that has happened over hundreds, if not thousands of years. People have articulated their wisdom in some way or their experience in some way. And you can learn without having to go just like aimlessly explore. You can learn from such incredible resources. And this is a great example of that, where this guy, Viktor Frankl, like I will, you know, hopefully never have to live through a war like he did. I won't have lived through the Holocaust like he did. And he has all this experience that I can't replicate even if I wanted to, right? And so he has this level of experience that he has layered on with his expertise in this case, where he was like a psychologist isn't even the right word for it, but he has now formed this almost like arm of psychology, which is logotherapy. And he's just, he's kind of taken some things that I will never be able to experience and also things that I do not know as deeply as him and combine them into this book that is just like, it's so easily readable if you haven't read it. And it helps you explore kind of like this concept of meaning, right? Which is universal. So he's taken things that I cannot get perspective on because I will not experience them, but he's made them accessible to me in a book in such a way that it's applicable to me as well and applicable to everyone in this concept of meaning. And I think he's just done it in such a beautiful way where, you know, really you can make arguments for how people live, how people make decisions, how they find their meaning through your own lens. But when you're really framing it from the perspective of what do people do when they're pushed against the wall, when they're living through something like a Holocaust, when they have no other option, when they literally are at a point where in theory they should be acting their worst, right? Responding in such a to such a horrible situation. But he shows in this book how people really find meaning even at the worst times. And I think you can kind of take that and really learn from it. You can learn from someone who literally lived through the Holocaust, was able to find meaning, how they found meaning. Then you're able to kind of understand how you may be able to find meaning. And there's this one really important takeaway from the book, which is this idea essentially that you always have a choice, right? You cannot control that which happens to you, but you can always control how you respond to that thing. And again, under this framing of like a lot of people complain, I complain, everyone complains in their lives, but with this framing of like, this is how someone can respond even through such dire times of living through a Holocaust. And it's like, okay, I can choose how I respond if my project doesn't go that well, or if I get fired, or if I break up with someone, right? Like I always have a choice. And I think that was among the many other takeaways in that book, a really significant one that I think everyone can learn from.
For sure. Regardless of what's happening externally, you always can choose your attitude to the situation. And I think one other big takeaway from that is there is no point seeking or searching for happiness or meaning. Happiness is a byproduct of kind of working towards something bigger than yourself. And it kind of comes as a result of that, which I constantly try to remind myself of. But an amazing, short, amazing book. Are there other examples of similar books that go back to the fundamentals that you've read or can think of, or you have on your to read list?
That's a good question. I've read so many books over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So right now I'm reading a book called When Breath Becomes Air. I'm around halfway through it, and it's an incredible book. Have you heard of it?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
Yeah. So again, I'm only halfway through, but it is one of these things that comes back to this, the fundamentals, where, you know, there's so many books out there that talk about exactly how to build habits or how to do X, Y, Z well, or how to be a good marketer and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, we're all going to live and die at some point. And, you know, what happens when we get to the end of our story? And this book is this amazing story of this doctor who spent years, you know, building up to become a doctor, as you do, right, over a decade. And then right at the end of that journey, he is diagnosed with lung cancer and he ends up dying from it. But throughout the journey of him kind of dealing with the cancer, he wrote this book, and it's incredible, at least so far from what I read from it. And I think that's when those are the kinds of books that we can really take significant learnings from. Whereas again, there's books that tell you exactly how to do X, Y, Z, but books like this help you really kind of reshape your perspective and remind you that at the end of the day, we're all here for a limited time. And you really just want to ask yourself again, how do you want to spend that time? Similar to Man's Search for Meaning, how do you want to make decisions every day with the understanding that you will die at some point, right? You have a choice, but at the same time, this is going to end in some way, shape, or form. So I think those books are really incredible. Another book that has shaped my thinking at kind of at a grand scale or a macro level is this book called Give and Take by Adam Grant. And that one is this concept of basically there's three types of people. There's givers, takers, and matchers. And pretty straightforward. Givers believe in this positive sum world. This kind of relates to, remember how I was talking about building in the open and mm-hmm. how I really do feel like the world is a positive sum game. If I help someone, even if they're in the same field as me, even if they're creating a very similar product to me, who, if I help them be successful, that does not take away from my chance of being successful. And this book really frames it where, so there's givers, takers are the opposite of that. Matchers believe in just the sense of reciprocity. And he showed that in many, many, many fields, there was this bell curve of success across the fields. And in the middle, there was takers and matchers, and at both ends. So the least successful and the most successful were givers, which he found really surprising, because you would expect that if takers are constantly leveling up by taking advantage of people, for example, that they would end up at the top, and they don't. So that was a really foundational book. And there's tons of amazing examples that he gives of people who have been able to, really succeed by embracing this idea of the world being positive sum. And then there's one other book that I think is really interesting, because I think, so there's, again, there's kind of personal development stuff. There's some business, finance, marketing stuff, but I really love any books that focus just purely on psychology. How do we think? How do we interact as humans? How do we make decisions? And one of them, which is less so about decisions or things like that, but is this book called Machete Season, which is about the Rwandan genocide. And it's really interesting because this book goes and it just interviews a bunch of people who literally were part of the genocide and killed their neighbors and did all this stuff that is really unimaginable. I like reviewing historical events like the Holocaust, as Man's Search for Meaning does, because it really just illuminates how, as humans, we think we won't do certain things, or we think that we're all good, but put in under certain circumstances, humans will do some crazy stuff. Right. And so this really was an interesting look into the psychology in terms of what brought these people to that you know, brink of literally going and killing their neighbors. It also, since this is post that event, it talks to them and tries to understand their mentality even after the event, how they've look back and view this event. And it was really illuminating. So I think those are some books that I think have really kind of shaped my view of people, how I think, how I can interact or be part of this, like, you know, 7 billion people world.
I'm counting.
Yeah, exactly. Which is really important, right? Because we all have autonomy on our own, but also, like, how do we fit within the scope of, like, literally there being 7 billion other people who also are autonomous and deciding their own life as well.
Steph, this has been truly amazing. I'd love to do this again and double click on some of these fundamental concepts and ideas that we just talked about, but on a high level, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for the great questions.